Last night we began the retreat by talking about cultivating certain qualities of mind and heart to create this. It's sometimes called taking your seat in practice, or, quote, creating a container. Not quite sure where these terms come from. Comes from that constant human urge to explain the inexplicable. But nonetheless, we talked about witnessing, creating this kind of witnessing presence that has a quality to it of friendliness. There's a teacher, I love his name. His name is, it took me months of like practicing in the mirror to get so I could even say it, even though it's not that hard once you can do it. Now I'm going to blow it. But his name is Nisargadatta Maharaj. And when you translate his name, kind of, again, roughly, it means Mr. Natural. Which is great. But he was this outrageous teacher. He kind of had been a cigarette salesman who hung out on the streets, I think, of Calcutta. And he had this fierce kind of manner, up in your face, kind of, what's it to you? How many cigarettes are you going to buy? You know, kind of trying to exact the most coinage for his product kind of way of being. And yet, his practice took him to this place of melting so that he would give people the instruction. He would say to them, cultivate affectionate attention. Allow your attention to be affectionate. So this tough guy, you know, giving this instruction to his students, very powerful. So that witnessing presence, having that quality of affection, that quality of kindness, and a kind of generosity of spirit toward the conditioned mind, compassion toward the conditioned mind. So the next quality, also hard to describe. We all know that we want it, but we don't often, we know what can impede it. I remember sitting with a teacher in this tradition who loves, he has almost evangelical flair, this delightful kind of fire and brimstone way of speaking, and he'd say, what you resist persists in the mind. And, you know, we'd all go, oh, yeah, it does. Because it's easier to describe our experience in those terms than to try to describe what this wonderful and moving and changing thing called letting go is. What is it? How do we get it? If we're trying to get it, then we're resisting and we're creating persistence. Quite amazing. So beginning this process of taking our seat with this affectionate attention, leaving the letting go up to the practice, not thinking that we are going to make it happen because we don't like some state of mind that's come or some experience. We want it to be done. We're through with it. The next I called remembering, cultivating this quality of concentration. Harder than we think. You know, there's that wonderful and very well-known story of P.D. Uspensky, who was a student of Gurdjieff. And he got up one morning, he said, today I will be mindful all the entire day. So, you know, it's Paris, he walks out the door, it's beautiful, you know, he sees a tobacco shop outside his apartment, and he remembers that he's out of out of cigarettes. And he goes in, he buys a pack of cigarettes, and he wanders the street, goes home, goes to bed, gets up the next morning, walks out, sees the tobacco shop, and goes, "Oh, I was going to be mindful all day yesterday." It's hard. So this remembering, this quality of coming back patiently and with this kind of gentle, and yet there's a kind of ornery quality to it when you get down to the bottom of it for a while. And our Sangha in Colombia, our logo was a mule, a Missouri mule, for just that very quality. We were outvoted, and it's now a lotus. We're much more cool. But it is that quality of remembering, coming back again and again to just simply awaken to what's here. That's all. The next, compassionate inquiry. When a state of mind and heart gets stuck, you know, some sort of mental loop comes in. There are a number of suttas in which the Buddha will actually sit down one of his students. There's one with his son, there are a number of these. And he will say to that person, "That thought, when brought to fruition, when cultivated, when acted upon, when given energy, would it be for your welfare or for your harm?" Just imagine what our world would be like if every single human being went through that quiet and very simple reflection before taking action. Just that one little movement, compassion going outward to the beings that you meet, compassion going inward, not living with regret, not living with remorse, not constantly being pulled out of the ability to concentrate by an unsettled heart, an unsettled mind. So compassionate inquiry, that brings us to taking responsibility, really starting to see, you know, I talked about in the equanimity practice how the mind is, it has this kind of delusional quality. It doesn't want to be held accountable. And so, you know, we'll meet someone on the street and our mind will think, "He hates me." And it's over, you know. So when we start moving in this way of witnessing, we see the mind go through those machinations and it becomes a delight. It becomes a gift that we give to the world. When I first started teaching, I did it reluctantly. I did not want to do it. And there was a great deal of terror in taking the Dharma seat. And this woman came to one of my classes, been many, many, many years ago. And she called before she came. She said, "I've been, you know, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of, you know, receiving someone's, I guess it's somebody's Dharma CV, you know." But she said, "I've been with Jack Kornfield, and I've been with Norm Fisher, who's a teacher in the Zen tradition, and I was with blah, blah, and blah, blah, and blah, blah, and blah, blah. And now I've moved to Columbia, Missouri. Can I come to your class?" And I said, "Sure, of course you can." So she came, and I noticed this intimidation coming up. The ego wanted its day in court. It wanted to take over. And I was giving this talk, and she kept, like, moaning out loud. and sighing, she would go, "Ah." And the mind wanted to pick up a pack of crayons and color in disapproval, judgment, all of that kind of stuff. And yet I knew that I was a warrior in that moment, and that if I did that, I would be performing an unconscionable act. You know, it's quite amazing. So that intention would come up to speak from that place. We've all done it. We've all said, "I know you think I'm blah, blah, blah." And the person goes, "Huh? What? Where'd that come from?" We've all done these things. But just feeling that intention come up the first time, the second time, the third time, and offering it up, letting it go. And after the class, she came up and she said, "I'm sorry. I know I was making a lot of noise, but what you said kept touching what's going on with me so deeply, and it just kept bubbling out. I'm sorry if I was a distraction." And that's what can happen when we hold our seat, take responsibility to allow things to arise naturally, not to keep spraying the world with our fear. Kabir says, "Fear, it's the cheapest room in the house." You know, it's all about self. It's all about protection. And most of the time, it's not true. So, compassionate inquiry, taking responsibility, and then the final kind of cultivation is the practice, the state that we worked on this evening, cultivating equanimity, this even, balanced sense is with the vicissitudes of life. It doesn't hide from them. It doesn't close down to them, but opens to them as they are. If grief arises, I have this friend who teaches in this tradition, and I stole his phrase. He would look at people with such compassion, and he'd say, "Let her rip." You know, grief comes up, let her rip. It will pass. And the learning from it is greater than trying to bypass it, get rid of it. I'm letting go now. So all of these qualities create this ability to meet life at the speed of life, meet life as it is. It creates this, it's interesting, some translations have called this the place of non-abiding. So there's a paradox there. We're not creating all these places to stand and then having to defend them against certain experiences. Instead, we're just with the flow of life as it is. And this I'm calling a refuge, creating a refuge. A refuge is not like a Bastille, because the world will storm it, and it's good at it. I've been delighted. I'm a TV nut, and I've been delighted by, I've sort of gotten a little more like Manindra, because I sit and watch these crazy things about people. This sweet guy who's an exterminator in Louisiana, but he won't kill anything unless he absolutely has to. So he'll catch these skunks, and he says, "Don't spray me now," you know, all that kind of stuff. He's very sweet. I love him. But I'm also addicted to these commercials that have been coming on about this guy who is mayhem. and he shakes limbs down on your tree, and he's a teenage girl on his cell phone, and he does all this stuff. Recently in my life, I've had every possible experience of that nature. And it's interesting to watch the mind want to establish a kind of beachhead on hating what is. Over and over it does. And then you just pat it. You have your friendly, affectionate attention. You say, so what if your furnace broke and it's $6,500 you don't have? It's going to be okay. No. Calm down. Just be there. Everybody, everything will come together, and then it does. It's quite amazing. Quite amazing. So not creating this tight, fight-based, fierce refuge for yourself, all based on the self, all based on nothing happening that you don't want. The Buddha had a list about refuges, taking refuge, and there were three things that one is asked to contemplate and take refuge in. And I look at these. Every year we go through this ceremony, both here at the New Year retreat, but we also do it in our Sangha. We offer this opportunity for all the people in the Columbia Sangha to do the refuges, take the refuges, and also take on as trainings the five householder precepts. And I'm always amazed by the kind of interesting thing that is happening in Columbia, because this has become a community gathering that goes beyond the boundary line of whether or not you would call yourself a Buddhist, because it is so clearly a training that fits in any wisdom tradition as a way to come into a place of freedom. So the Sufis all come, and the people from the Unity Church, and all these people, it sort of spread word of mouth, and all these people from different wisdom traditions come and take on these refuges and precepts, and do not draw some sort of line about it at all. It's quite something. It's a night of peace for all of us. So the first refuge is taking refuge in and hearing this with great care, not so much in the historical Buddha, but taking refuge in the potential within your own being for that level of peace and freedom to occur. There's a teacher who wrote a book, and it's called In This Very Life. In This Very Life. The whole book is about the absolute glowing potential that each human being has to come out of the forest of their conditioned mind and to walk forth in freedom. So that potential, that ability to entertain that possibility, is all that is asked. Taking refuge in the Buddha nature within each of us. What that does, that has such power, such a gift, such a potential, is that it literally opposes a lot of the mind's conditioning. All the Buddha identified these things he called conceits. One of them being not enough, that each human mind believes itself to be not enough. At some point, sort of flowing in and out all day, we'll have these experiences like the one I described with my class, where suddenly we're not enough somehow. When you look at the historical Buddha, there was a moment in his practice very, you know, much a part of the historical record. About the eve of his enlightenment, he's seated under the tree of enlightenment, and Mara, who is, you know, it's not like the devil, really. Mara is the mind, all the ways that the mind undermines us and creates all this kind of, you know, different states of mind. Are described as the sons and the daughters of Mara. Some of them are seductresses and some of them are warriors, and it goes on and on. But the Buddha is seated under the tree of enlightenment, and he's made a vow. He says, okay, this is it. I won't get up until I come into a state of complete freedom. Because he could sense, he'd watched his mind so much, he could sense the possibility of moving through life from a place beyond conditioning, the unconditioned, the state of complete freedom. Nobody born, nobody dies. He sensed it. When he said that, Mara came to him, his own mind, and said, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to become free? And in that moment, the Buddha gave one of the most powerful teachings that he has given, in my estimation, just from my own experience. Because what knocks us off balance, what takes us off course again and again and again, is hearing some kind of thought in the mind and believing it and then becoming more and more agitated on behalf of it. So hearing that, oh, you're right, I'm not enough, and we're gone. So the Buddha took his hand and he touched the earth. And that is the simple practice that we all can make whenever we notice that occurrence. Whenever we start falling into the mind stream thrill ride. Whenever we're pulled into suffering. Here it is. The Buddha touched the earth. He said, the earth is my witness. I have that right. I said this in one of the groups. He didn't do it from a place of, like, belligerence. He didn't say, nanny, nanny, boo, boo, I have that right. The earth's on my side. That's not what it was about. It was about just waking up. What's here now? Just the mind screaming, oh. Okay, witnessing, inquiring with compassion, taking responsibility, meeting it with equanimity, meeting that experience. So the first refuge, taking refuge in the Buddha, can be using the historical teachings of the Buddha as practices by which to become free. But also, beyond that, to recognize that that possibility is very real and alive in all our minds, all our hearts, that it is possible. The second refuge, taking refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma is an interesting word, translated, again, just kind of roughly. It means, It doesn't just mean truth with a capital T, like the big truth, concrete block, we set it down and it never changes, it's always the same. It is the flow, the changing nature of things, this movement of truth. You don't step in the same river twice, and truth is constantly showing itself in each moment. So the Dharma can mean the historical teachings from the Buddha passed down through all these monks and nuns as an oral tradition for 500 years and then written down finally. But it also means to take refuge in awakening to the deepest truth that we can fathom in each moment of our lives. And allowing that not to be some big, huge deal, some huge undertaking, you know, like climbing Mount Everest, but rather an ordinary and simple practice. The practice of hearing the Dharma through the dishwasher repairman. Hearing the Dharma. When my daughter was ill, one of her coworkers came up. And it was quite amazing. He was probably mid-50s. And he had that glow. The glow of love, the glow of compassion, the glow of kindness. Just emanating. He had just changed jobs after working as a nurse in a dialysis unit for most of his career. And suddenly, he just started working in the emergency room with my daughter. And he came up and he sat by her bed and he said to her, she actually roused to speak to him. She was not rousing to speak to anyone. But she roused for Jerry, and he said to her, Caitlin, you're in a very important place now. You're on the other side of the bed. Use this experience. Allow it to teach you. You're already an amazing nurse. Let this take your heart into compassion. Let it take you the rest of the way. And I'm sitting there going, wow, wow, so beautiful. He left. My daughter, you know, finally started to get better. They discharged her. We're driving along together, and I said to her, wasn't that amazing what Jerry said to you? She said, did Jerry come to see me? I said, yeah. She said, what did he say? You know, all these parents, you know, always wanting to be the one to deliver the words of wisdom. I felt so honored to be able to deliver Jerry's words to my daughter. It was just a gift. And I told her, and she's over, you know, wiping her face. And she said, that's Jerry. He's like that. You know, just she had such respect for him. But that's the refuge in the Dharma, allowing the truth, the teachings of truth to come to us and hearing them. And if we're out of it and we can't hear them, to hope that a dear friend passes the word along later. But taking refuge in the Dharma, taking refuge in the way the world teaches us to let go into truth. The final refuge, taking refuge in Sangha. Sangha is a word that means, it could mean the collection of monks and nuns that stewarded this tradition during the time that it was an oral tradition, till the time that it began, people began to write these things down. Also, it means the community of fellow practitioners. This wonderful gift that we look around in this room and see present here. There is a Sangha here, taking refuge in the Sangha. The Buddha said, of all the three, this is the greatest one. Now, why? I can tell you from teaching, I don't even know how many retreats by now, but there have been so many times that I have observed people inspiring each other and not even realizing it, just by being themselves, by getting up early in the morning and going in and practicing with devotion, and that devotion touching others who then follow that. There's another inspiration, the wonderful gift of being irritated, that we notice even in this peaceful place of silence that certain people can irritate us. And because we're in the process of looking deeply instead of leaving it there, we move it into our own responsibility and thereby learn from it. I had this experience of, I was at a retreat, and you know, you write your name on the cup with the tape and the whole thing. And what nobody ever says, I've never heard a single soul tell anybody this, that if you're left-handed, you better turn the cup around because somebody might have already put their name on it. And you can go the entire retreat drinking and looking at only one side of the cup. So I put my name on this cup that I really like, that I staked out because it didn't get too hot from the tea and it was the perfect cup. And then somebody came along who was left-handed and put their name on the other side. And I found that the most irritating. It was hilarious. And yet, I got to work with it. I got to work with that space of becoming so hoo-hooed over a coffee cup. What? So taking refuge in the Sangha can be an empowering, fierce practice. So the next thing that we will work with tonight are what are called five householder precepts or trainings. They're called mindfulness trainings because they're not just do and don't do. They again become part of this moving, changing nature of truth, how things are constantly moving. When we set up precepts and hold to them hard and fast, what can happen is we lose the spirit of the law by becoming lost in the forest of the letter of the law. I read this article, I ran into it on the internet, about all these people who had, you know, they fought this valiant battle with the Catholic Church for several years because they had celiac disease, which makes wheat host deadly for them. You know, not a good idea. And they asked if they could substitute rice cracker or something else. And finally, the church took a look at that and said, you know, what? Of course. But it took several years. Because we want so much often to do the right thing, to be, you know, following these guidelines, that sometimes the guidelines themselves can take us under and we get lost in them. So these five precepts have to do with really following a path of a kind of ethical, moral sensitivity, where we use these trainings as a way to remain sensitive and to not fall prey to rigidity. Sometimes I found this, and I found it delightful. This was used in a job application for one corporation. And this is the deal. You're driving along in your car on a stormy night. You pass by a bus stop, and you see three people waiting for the bus. An old lady who looks as if she's about to die. I love these things. An old friend who once saved your life. The perfect partner you have been dreaming about. So which one would you offer a ride to, knowing that there could only be one passenger in your car? So this is the question they ask. You could pick up the old lady because she's going to die, and thus you should save her first, or you could take the old friend because he saved your life, and this would be the perfect chance to pay him back. But you might never find that perfect mate again. Isn't this wonderful? This so shows us the way our minds work, you know, all the way that we get lost in these forests of rationalization. The candidate who was hired out of 200 applicants came up with this answer. He said, and I love it, "I would give the car keys to my old friend and let him take the lady to the hospital. And I would stay behind and wait for the bus with my perfect partner." You can see that there are all these creative ways of working with precepts, that they both require humor, delight, courage. I've told this story 1,000 times. Here it comes again. But as one of my patients when I was a play therapist, there was this little Amish girl, a tiny, delicate little blonde with her little braids and her bonnet and the whole thing. And it was part of her culture to sell things. Her family would set up these roadside stands and sell eggs and homemade bread and jam and things like that. And she was literally living in the hospital. She'd been living there for months and months and months. And so I bought a bunch of, like, lemonade mix, and we set up a lemonade stand. And we were making money hand over fist. People were paying $10 for a cup of lemonade because they'd look in her eyes and go, "Oh, here." So she was making a lot of money and very delighted about it. When somebody called the press, they thought it would be cute to have this photograph, you know, good for the hospital. One of the docs did it. And this gigantic, tall, fierce, because the University of Missouri is known for training its journalists to stick their foot in the door and get that shot, you know, that's part of the deal. So this very fierce young man came, and he got down on one knee, and he held up this camera. And I'm going, "Oh." And this tiny little girl, and she must have been 8 years old at that time, she walked right up to him, and she said, "Sir, I'm not allowed to have my photograph taken. It's against my religious practices." And he went, "Well, I don't care. You didn't call me. A doctor called me." And she said, "I'm sorry." And the doctor who had called stood up and said, "I did it. I'm sorry. I forgot. You can't take the shot. You have to go." Huge. So to have the courage to speak from a place of heart and conviction without rigidity, with this sweetness, kindness. It's not about having to negate the other side, just to speak your truth. So, taking these precepts, taking them on, it's interesting. All the qualities that I mentioned, the mindfulness, the remembering, concentration, the inquiry, all of those qualities are cultivated through the simple act of taking them on and living our life through them. That when we go through a day in which we're not sitting with some little ethical dilemma or another, we know that we haven't paid attention. You know, that you're on the phone and the person is asking you to bash someone, not to discuss how to better relate to someone. And you really want to, and yet you wake up and know that all you have to do is shift the conversation toward skillfulness, toward using that relationship for the deepening of both people. So, working with these precepts is an amazing gift. It's an opportunity. I'm going to stop talking now. Before I do, I'm going to read you something. This is from the Sufi wisdom tradition. It's from Hafiz, who's this wonderful, delightful, heart-open poet from the 14th century. And it really rings, to me, it describes taking an opportunity, really using something like five householder precepts as an opportunity, a way to awaken in life just through living our ordinary lives. He says, now is the time to know that all you do is sacred. Now, why not consider a lasting truth with yourself and God? If you want to change that word to the unconditioned, to truth, go right ahead. Doesn't really matter. Now is the time to understand that all your ideas of right and wrong were just a child's training wheels. Now listen to this carefully. To be laid aside when you can finally live with veracity and love. You know, to let go of those training wheels, to use those training wheels, but to know when to let go of them and live through our love. Hafiz is a divine envoy whom the Beloved has written a holy message upon. My dear, please tell me, why do you still throw sticks at your heart and God? What is in that sweet voice inside that incites you to fear? Now is the time for the world to know that every thought, every action is sacred. Now is the time for you to deeply compute the impossibility that there is anything but grace. Now is the season to know that everything you do is sacred. So I will close with that. It's 11:02. We're going to make it. So, if you need a break now, please take a short one while our musicians get themselves organized. They're already pretty organized, but to come up in the front, just stand and stretch and bring some energy in. I'm going to have some Sprite.